Hello, this is Gary Mack. Welcome to Episode 7 of the Last Post Radio Show podcast. For Australia, the Vietnam War began in a small way. It started in 1962 with the arrival in Saigon of 30 Australian Army jungle warfare and counterinsurgency experts to help train the South Vietnamese. They were known as the Team. 3 years later, as the situation worsened and the Americans began committing large ground forces, an Australian infantry battalion was sent there. Over 10 years, 60,000 Australians, Navy, Army and Air Force, were to see service in Vietnam. And a third of the troops were conscripts, national servicemen. By mid-1966, two Australian infantry battalions were in Vietnam, along with artillery, including New Zealand gunners, armoured corps, engineers, logistics, and an SAS unit operating from their own base in Nui Det, southeast of Saigon, and responsible for the security of a major part of Phuc Thoi province. It was a very small force to carry out major operations, constant patrols, always within sight and even earshot of communist Viet Cong guerrillas. Vietnam was unlike any war Australia had ever fought. There were no front lines or safe areas. The whole countryside was the front line, riddled with Viet Cong, who fought with toughness and dedication. In mid-August 1966, just 2 months after the Australians were established at Nui Det, a company of the 6th Battalion, just 108 men, made contact with the enemy only 4 kilometres east of the base in the Long Tan rubber plantation and fought an epic 3-hour battle of survival, suffering more than 40 killed and wounded, but killing more than 200 of the enemy. This famous battle was fought within earshot of the base at Nui Det. Long Tan was a victory, but victories were few in Vietnam. When it seemed the communists had been outfought, the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese Army launched the savage Tet Offensive early in 1968, showing that victory was still a long way off, if not impossible, to achieve. The Australians' war in Vietnam dragged on until 1972, a war of constant patrols and ambushes, abortive attempts to bring an elusive enemy to battle. 523 soldiers died as a result of the war, and almost 2,400 were wounded. The war was the cause of the greatest social and political dissent in Australia since the conscription referendums of the First World War. Many draft resistors, conscientious objectors and protesters were fined or jailed, while soldiers met a hostile reception upon their return home. Australia's participation in the war was formally declared at an end when the Governor-General issued a proclamation on the 11th of January 1973. The only combat troops remaining in Vietnam were a platoon guarding the Australian Embassy in Saigon, which was withdrawn in June 1973. As part of this edition of the Last Post Radio Show podcast, that was a potted background of Australia's involvement in the Vietnam War from 1962 through to 1972. It's a part of our history, and it's a part of the reason of why we're here today, to fill in a few gaps and also give you an idea about what the country is about. Greg T. Ross has just returned from Vietnam. Welcome back, old boy.
Well, thank you very much, Gary Mack, and what a pleasure it is to speak with you and to listeners for the Last Post Radio Show, and to speak about the recent trip to Vietnam.
Yeah, it was 4 weeks in length, wasn't it?
It was Gary. It went from the beginning of February till I think the 1st of March from memory, and it all went by so quickly. But there was a hell of a lot that we got up to, a hell of a lot that we learned, and a hell of a lot of nice people we met. So wonderful.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing about the trip. Now, you took off, as you say, early February 2024. You arrived where?
Well, we flew to originally Singapore, waited around there for a few hours, and then to Da Nang. We landed at Da Nang, and we were picked up there by a driver called Bin Bin.
What did you say when you got off the aircraft at Da Nang?
Good morning, Vietnam!
Yes, and that's exactly what I said, and funnily enough, that movie was on the plane flying up to Vietnam, Gary, so I've got a good view of that.
It was probably on the way back as well, because I know that they play that movie a lot in and out of Vietnam.
I know it word perfect.
Now, you were picked up by a delightful young driver by the name of Bin Bin in Da Nang, and he drove you then to Hoi An. How long did that trip take?
That trip, Bin Bin took us to Hoi An from Da Nang. That went, I guess, for about 40 minutes. The first impressions I got of Vietnam from that was that there's a hell of a lot of motorbikes and scooters around, and you know, somehow they seem to manage it. There's very few traffic lights, very few seemingly rules and regulations on the road, but somehow they seem to avoid collisions. I don't know if I'd have the strength or guts to go through that myself, but yeah.
It's quite extraordinary. I've seen a lot of video of those scooters. That's the chosen form of transport over there, everybody, and sometimes you see two or three people on a scooter as well.
Oh, well, I took a photo of one scooter there, Gary, and there was the rider of the scooter, then his three children, plus the dog. So there seemed to be laneways everywhere, and just such an interesting thing to sit in the car there and observe. But yeah, about 40 minutes, and the warmth, of course. We'd arrived during the Tet celebrations, more on that a bit later, but of course, very, very busy. Markets everywhere, it was incredible.
Just to give us an idea of the costs involved, what sort of fare would you pay Bin Bin for his 40-minute trip?
Well, the dong is undervalued compared to the Australian dollar, so it might be, say, 150,000 dong. Now, before you take a deep breath and go, geez, that probably works out to be about $17 or $18.
So is that right? That much?
Yeah, so that's right. So I was briefly a millionaire in Vietnam too, Gary, because, of course, in my wallet I had millions of dollars worth of dong.
Yes. All right, back to Hoi An. How did that city impress you? Obviously, you spent a bit of time.
A beautiful city. It is a World Heritage Site, has been since 1999, I think, and normally it has about 120,000 people in it. However, Gary, during the Tet celebrations, that probably quadrupled, and it was a hustling, bustling city. So all in all, a most beautiful area, with beautiful rivers and markets, and I guess the old town that has the old Japanese bridge there too, which was built in the 16th or 17th century. So a most interesting city. But all the time, of course, during Tet, people coming up and wanting to sell you things. So that can, you've got to be prepared for that.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, the meeting, I suppose, Hoi An apparently translated means a peaceful meeting place, and I imagine that during the off-tourist season it would be just that.
Well, you must have met a lot of people and mixed with the local people there too. What were they really like?
Beautiful people, Gary. We did come across, just as a particular instance, we came across a little cafe. And look, most of the people that run these businesses do so from their own houses, so their houses are open to the street, and you can see grandma watching television a room down from the hallway, and they'll have their goods out the front of the shop. It may even be a cafe or a restaurant, but in the background, it's all very homely. We met a wonderful woman by the name of Flower, and her husband was Viet, as in Vietnam, and Flower's food was absolutely marvellous. But Flower, I tell you what, she did everything. She arranged the laundry, she arranged the tours, she even sold tickets to the local theatre production. She was a busy woman.
They say that a woman's work is never done. I think they wrote the book about her.
Oh, yes, indeed. And no, Flower was wonderful. And she did give me some mushroom wine, which was an experience. So, yeah.
Mushroom wine? Tell me more.
Well, I said to her, I saw she had a bottle of gin there, a brand that I favour, and I said, can I have some of that? She goes, no, that's my husband. He'd kill me. But you can have the mushroom wine. I said, well, I'm in a brave mood. I might as well try that. And we did. But yeah, but just a lovely thing. So all the businesses are houses, and it's just very family orientated people, Gary.
Yeah, yeah, I get that impression. I certainly do. Now, your first visit away from your base at Hoi An was to My Lai, which is an infamous part of the world for it having been the place where U.S. troops massacred an entire village. What was your intent and impressions from that visit?
Look, I had no idea. I had to admit my ignorance. I had no idea we were so close to My Lai, and once I found out that we were within 2 hours driving, I said, look, have to go, because, of course, growing up and obviously keeping an eye on the Vietnam War as a youngster, this was something that happened in March, I think it was, 1968, but wasn't revealed for a year later, involved the mass murder of, you know, unarmed civilians. Now, of course, both sides were responsible for the killing of people in horrendous ways, and that's the tragedy of warfare. But it did leave a mark on the world and also helped turn the tide against the Vietnamese War. One of the things that was striking, Gary Mack, was that when the American troops arrived, the village had been going about its peaceful morning business, and it was quite muddy, apparently. So there's footsteps, etc., that were put in the mud. So what they've done is they've cemented that over so the footsteps and these remain. What I saw was children's footprints, women's footprints, and U.S. Marine footprints, and also a dog's footprints, and apparently even the dogs were killed. But there was a push bike there that had been going in one direction and then suddenly appeared to stop and do a U-turn, and maybe a kid had seen the American troops and tried to get away. But a very poignant, very moving, and I guess just once again reiterating the tragedy of warfare and why we must do everything we can to stop it. But yeah, we drove back to Hoi An very, very silent, very silent.
Yes, I think you've put that very well. It's a poignant thing to be in an environment like that, and there must be an air of sadness about it all as well. I mean, okay, we've moved on from the Vietnam War, but there must be an air of sadness at all times. And I've spoken to a number of vets who saw action in Vietnam, and I understand perhaps why many of them don't really want to talk about it, because it brings back those memories, you know. But it was then. I know that the country has moved on. We've all moved on. I'm glad that you saw that, because that's, as you say, was something that you heard about when you were growing up.
Indeed, and to stand there at the village and the foundations of the huts are still there, the footprints are still there. It looked like a beautiful village. But of course, there were, I think there was about three US soldiers and officers who tried to stop it. But that's that. So yeah, as I say, poignant, important part of the war, and did help to turn a public opinion against the war. So, but I will say this one thing, the Vietnamese are very, very embracing, inclusive and forgiving people. And the warmth of their friendship and willingness and wish for us to understand what they've been through was quite incredible. So bless them for that.
Absolutely. Now, on a brighter side, of course, Hoi An is well known for its restaurants, and I know that you're well known for taking the munge at restaurants from time to time, pouring the odd martini. And did you find any good restaurants in Hoi An?
Well, did we? Well, I'll tell you what, this is one of the blessings. Gary, and listeners, I think if you're going to Vietnam, make sure you do go to Hoi An, because if you like good food, you've come to the right spot. There was a place called Morning Glory, and we went there for the second time, and they said, oh, you get a 10% discount, you're a regular. And this was on the second visit, so I thought, oh, maybe I've been here longer than I realised, but the food was glorious, and what we would do was go up in the first floor balcony to avoid the street sellers coming in trying to flog you off stuff, and have a lovely view of the whole area. And there was a place called the Spice Route. These, and look, we were walking down a laneway one night too, Gary, and just by perchance, a beautiful, authentic Indian restaurant. Some of the best Indian food that we've ever had, and quite amazing. Down these alleyways, what you'll find.
I've also spoken to a number of other friends who've done exactly that, and you can get lost, but it's a joy to be lost in that kind of environment.
Oh, aren't you so right? And it was so funny because walking back to the bridge to cross over to go back to where we were staying, sometimes would get lost.
Yeah.
And I'd say, look, I know the way, follow me. And sure enough, as Greg's had a habit of doing in the past, Greg was wrong.
Ah, well, yes.
And I thought, haven't we been here before? We've done a full circle.
Well, it serves you right. You should just find another bar and pour in another martini. Now, obviously, you were there during what they call Tet, which is the Lunar New Year in Asian countries. Mm. I guess it was pretty busy.
Well, yes, it was, Gary. And it's known as Tet. It's probably the most significant festival in Vietnam and their holidays. So basically they shut down for 4 days. But in the lead up and directly afterwards, it's go, go, go. It's a nationwide celebration marking the dawn of the new year, obviously, in the traditional lunar calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And the holiday dates, they change each year, but typically fall between, I think, mid-January and late February. So this obviously was during our time there. And the colour... the noise, the singing, and the selling. Of course, everyone's trying to flog you off something, so you can hardly walk two steps without someone suggesting you should buy something. And you have to learn to either ignore it or say politely, no, thank you. So.
Mm-hmm. You drove to Hue,
yes.
Which was the former capital of Vietnam for some time, and very much, I understand, the old Vietnam. I mean, obviously, the old Vietnam was a place, you know, so totally different to the kind of world that we're living in now.
Yes.
And we understand that Hue was the imperial city.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Was there
yes.
any reason why you went there?
It came about in a funny way because I met an American couple, Bruce and Rhoda, who were lovely. We went to Da Nang with them and also went to Hue with them. And they're well and truly back in Washington State now. But a lovely couple, they told us they were going to Hue and asked if we wanted to come. But we stopped at this restaurant or cafe for a coffee on the way. And this Vietnamese guy who was serving the coffee came up to me and said, "Are you Australian?" I said, "Yeah." And he looked like he was just about to collapse with happiness. He said, "My brother lives in Melbourne.
Mm.
I'm just trying to save up money to get there, you know." But then we went to Hue and saw the Imperial City, which was a marvel, dropped off Bruce and Rhoda, and we went to our hotel. But the unfortunate thing was there, Gary, is that we had planned to spend a couple of days there, but it's not Deli Belly, but there was some food poisoning involved, and I was quite okay, but my partner was quite ill, and so we had to request to go back the next day, mate.
Did that require medical attention? Did you have to go to a hospital or an emergency area?
No, just rest and a lot of buckets and
oh, dear.
The toilet. So
yes, yes. Don't go there. But I know,
no.
I know. Look, I do know that you have to be careful. I mean, the word. In fact, this is some of the instructions that people will find if they're planning on trips to Vietnam and elsewhere. That you don't use the local water. You don't drink the local water.
No, don't drink the water. Always drink bottled water.
Bottled water and all of that. Yeah, and be careful of, just simply be careful. It's not quite like it is in Western countries.
No, that's right. Always go to busy places.
Yep.
And look, a lot of the times the little cafes and that in the side alleys are probably the best bet because they're so busy and popular.
Mm.
But this instance was just bad luck in that sense. But my reaction was my stomach took some time, about a week, to get used to it. And then after that, I mean, I was okay. But yeah, after getting used to it, and the food is so beautiful, it's impossible to resist.
Well, hopefully Claire bounced back quickly and you continued on, I believe, to Saigon.
We went to Saigon. Part of the reason for the trip, obviously, was apart from the Hoi An base, was to see some areas and events that were significant during the Vietnam War, Gary. And, of course, Saigon as it was known as Ho Chi Minh City now, but a lot of the locals, the South Vietnamese, still call it Saigon. And I say South Vietnamese because they made it very clear to us that they preferred Saigon. What they did is they said a lot of the North Vietnamese people considered the South Vietnamese people to be losers because they lost the Civil War. And they said that that feeling still continues, believe it or not, in some people. But they were all very well educated and spoke to us about the war. But we went to Saigon, and I guess there's a lot of things. One of the points that we're doing in the Anzac Day edition of The Last Post, Gary, is to look at photojournalists. Tim Page was one of them. And, of course, we went to the Continental Hotel, which is a beautiful, beautiful
Yeah, I understand hotel. The Continental is really the place.
I could just see you there sitting back and having a beer or a wine, mate. It's beautiful.
Yes, well, just pour a nice, just a nice, friendly Johnny would be nice.
I know. Well, that's right. You'd get a nice there too. And the garden is where the US military would give their talks at the end of each day about the progress of the war to journalists. And then we went to the Rex, where the 5 o'clock follies, as they called them, because the US military also spoke at the Rex up at the garden. I think it's the fifth floor. We went up there for dinner, and the 5 o'clock follies, where they would tell the press about how they were winning the Vietnam War and everything.
Yes.
And amongst that, obviously, was Sean Flynn, the son of Errol.
Yes. Well, I was going to say, actually, Sean Flynn obviously is related to. To His Royal Highness Errol, yes.
Yeah, that's right. He was his son and just as good looking. And Sean was a friend of Tim Page's, and Tim obviously, they never found Sean's body, but it's believed he was kidnapped by the Khmer Rouge.
Oh, dear.
And also amongst the press up there were the Steinbeck brothers, the sons of the great John Steinbeck. And they and Tim would go there and... But they soon grew a bit tired, I think, of hearing the military saying how they were winning the war when they weren't. So you could feel the whole atmosphere there. It was quite an amazing hotel. And that's another one that I'd recommend people visit when they go to Saigon is the Rex and the Continental. We went to the War Remnants Museum in Saigon too, Gary.
Now, tell me about the War Remnants Museum. Is that a big place?
It is. It's quite imposing. Look, there was this chap there who approached us. He had both his arms blown off by a US landmine and one of his legs and one of his eyes. But he knew Tim Page. And when I told him that I had been friends with Tim, he became quite emotional. So that was a striking thing about going to the museum to find in Saigon someone that knew Tim Page. It was quite incredible.
But yeah.
They've got all these tanks and things. And they've got demonstrations of the South Vietnamese government's torture chambers, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the most interesting thing was the Requiem, which was organised by Tim Page, as a tribute to missing and believed dead journalists and photographers during the war, Gary.
Yes, well, that happened quite often, missing in action.
Yeah, well, it was incredible. So they had their works on the Requiem, which I think was the second floor from memory, a beautiful thing. But out the front, we had the old Huey helicopters, an F-5A fighter and a Daisy Cutter bomb there. And I guess the message there was, too, that some of these bombs that were made by the Viet Cong cost a dollar to put together but could destroy a $1 million tank, you know?
Yes.
So there was a pattern, a tank, an M-48 pattern tank out the front there too, and a Dragonfly attack bomber, which incredible. They were still in remarkably good condition. But I'd recommend that people go to the War Remnants Museum also and up to the second floor to see the Requiem. It'll take you about 3 hours for a solid look. It's just an amazingly interesting place where you're immersed in history. And the photographic display... at the Requiem, it's just incredible, Gary. It would knock your socks off.
Okay, I'll put that most certainly on the bucket list. You know, as part of the success, if you will, of the Viet Cong was their labyrinth or their warrens of tunnels, which were everywhere around Saigon and or Ho Chi Minh City, as it's known now. And your visit to the Chu Chi tunnels?
Yep. That's the one. Yeah.
You actually climbed underground and you went for a bit of a wander.
Yeah, I did go down and I felt claustrophobic. I I lasted 30 metres.
Oh, really?
And I had to get out.
Yeah.
And so Claire lasted 50 metres. But the scary thing is, Gary, and to listeners, is that that actually widened these tunnels for Western people who are big like me.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, because most Asian people are much smaller than their Western counterparts. You know, blokes like you and I'd get stuck down a tunnel, although I'm looking fairly trim, taut, and terrific, I'll have you know.
You are good for you are good.
No, I've lost a few kilos, so yeah, I'm feeling good.
Is, there was a big American there, he looked like a footballer.
Mm.
And he could not get down the tunnel, so he just had his photo taken at the entrance. There's no way that he could get, and this is what the Viet Cong knew. They thought if they make them small enough to fit in, the Americans got no way of getting down there because they're bigger.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
It was just it was an immense network, really. And of course, being so close to Saigon was part of the way that it underlied much of the country. But these, the Chu Chi tunnels, I guess there were campaigns around that, including the Tet Offensive in 1968, you know, where they actually came up in the U.S. Embassy, which gave the Yanks a bit of a scare. But, yeah, they're hiding spots during combat. They would just often wonder how the Americans ever thought they would win, because the Viet Cong in particular would design their sandals to appear as though they were walking backwards. It's very hard to explain, but they would also cook without smoke, speak without talking. I'm still in awe. But underneath these tunnels, Gary, there were hospitals, food and weapon caches, and, you know, living quarters for the fighters. And they ran onto a river, which is where they would escape when the Americans came. But the smoke also, they would cook, of course, underground, but the smoke was directed so that it would come out in a hole, maybe, let's say, 50 or 60 metres away. So the Americans, until they twigged, would start dropping bombs down the hole where the smoke was coming from. But that was nowhere near where the Viet Cong actually were. So,
So they were fairly cunning at warfare.
Oh, look, they are so ground street smart. Let's put it that way. It's probably the best way that Westerners can twig to that. They are so smart. And things that we don't think of, they just go about it as though it's second nature. Very, very smart people. There's a natural intellect there, which obviously helped them during the war. But the conditions of the tunnels, I mean, the American soldiers, I think, Gary, used the term black echo because the tunnels were so difficult to negotiate, you know. And they're infested with ants and venomous, I think, centipedes, we were told, snakes and scorpions.
Yeah. Plus, you'd be largely in the dark. If you had a flashlight, well, that's a little different, but you'd largely be in the dark the whole time.
Yes, I don't know how they did it, because, of course, claustrophobia affects a lot of Westerners, I think. But, geez, mate, I tell you what. Nah. It's funny, because the guy that was there, he said, you're here, he said, you must go down. You'll regret it for the rest of your life if you don't. So, yes.
Now, part of your study, you as being editor-in-chief and publisher of The Last Post magazine, and your involvement here with the podcast, part of your work and trip to Vietnam was to also visit a very well-known name, the Mekong Delta.
Oh, Gary, I tell you what, look, I've fallen in love with the Mekong Delta and the people in it. Of course, a major part of the Vietnam War, where the Viet Cong hid and often would use bamboo breathers to hide under the water.
Yes.
To ambush the Americans. And I'll tell you what, Gary, going down the Mekong Delta and its tributaries, which we did, I felt, all these years later, I felt for the American troops. You would have been pooing your pants every 5 seconds.
Oh, really?
There was just boats, houses, markets floating on the amazing river. And we just, it's known as the Nine Dragon River Delta, which is actually, the Mekong Delta is the westernized version, but it's easier to say and shorter. But it's in southwestern Vietnam, and it's where the Mekong River approaches and empties into the sea. So there's a lot of just, you know, tributaries around there. But the people, the food, the villages that we walked through, where they share and they grow food for each other. So let's say you might grow some corn and your next door neighbor's got some rice. There's no starving. He'll give you the rice, you give them the corn, and happy. So it's all this sharing. It's built on an understanding of sharing. But to go through the Mekong Delta and to experience this beautiful part of the country was, to me, it's just a treasure trove.
I remember, this is now going back several years, and I may have been maybe clouded by other movies that may have been made in that same area, but I recall it was either a documentary or it was a dramatized movie that was made of a man who was taken prisoner, a South Vietnamese man who was taken prisoner by the Viet Cong near the Mekong Delta, the river, and his lady friend, who I think he was betrothed to, he was maybe engaged or about to be married when he was captured, and he made this remarkable swim across the currents of that river to the other side where his where his lady was. And I believe that it was either a documentary, I'm going back now many years ago, or it was a dramatized movie, but it was a really moving movie to watch. It would be something that I'd like to see if I could find and maybe have another look at it, you know. It sounds like an incredible place.
Yeah, you'd love it. There's no doubt about it. You would love it. So you take off and you're obviously on a boat. There's so many boats. And again, it's very much like the motorcycle law. It appears as though you're going to crash with these boats, but they always navigate around each other. It's beautiful. And, of course, I also got to feed the crocodiles.
Oh, really?
Yes. Well, look, the crocodiles there are killer beasts. They are incredible. I didn't feel like being offered as part of their lunchtime menu. So no. I did feed them. And
well, you're not all that tasty either, you know.
I wasn't going to let the crocodiles to decide. But it was just an amazing place. I know that you would love it. It's a low-lying coastal place. And we'll put on a show, Gary, and listeners, where traditional music was played. And these wonderfully beautiful women in traditional dresses came out and danced and sang. Claire actually even got up and joined them.
This is your first trip to Vietnam, right?
Yes, it is, Gary, and I think combined with the work for the coming edition and for our chat today, there was a lot of lovely moments of peacefulness and rest to wake up looking out over the rice fields and the river.
Yep.
And to see the buffalo. The buffalo were funny. They didn't seem to know what they're doing. They'd cross the river, and then they'd all stop, and then they'd come back. I don't know if I could do it 12 months a year, but it was certainly a beautiful place to be. Yeah.
You found a beautiful escape in Sham Island, is that right?
Funny that we came about this quite serendipitously. Claire and I had taken a walk, a 6 kilometre walk from Hoi An to An Bang Beach one day because we wanted to exercise. And along the way, I found a bunch of Norwegian tennis players playing tennis on a court. That's another story. But we got to An Bang Beach and had a swim and a beer, a nice cold tiger beer. And I noticed this island. I said to Claire, look, what is that? I wonder. It looks mysterious. So did some Googling and discovered it was actually Cham Island, which is a group of 8 islands. And so we organised to go out there. The first time we stayed for 3 nights and the second time a week later for another 2 nights, looked after by Yong and his wife, Mi. And they would go to the market for us, get the latest fish.
Oh, wow.
Oh, you would love it. And the fish is falling off the bone. And they would cook it for us and present it to us. And, of course, at a rate where it probably only cost about $3, you know.
Good Lord.
Yeah, I know, mate. And I think the first time we stayed there 3 nights, including accommodation, food, and, of course, martinis and beers,
sure,
it came to $100 each. That's for accommodation for 3 nights.
Good
food
Lord.
Food and beverages, $100.
That's incredible.
And it was beautiful, actually. It was so, it was very family feeling there because Yong and his wife, their granddaughter was staying with them, and she went to the local school. And one day she came up to Claire and she said, can you walk me to school? So I walked with Claire and this young 8-year-old girl to school, and we went into the school and we were so welcomed by the children there. It was such a beautiful, beautiful experience. There's idyllic beaches there, and one of them is only 300 metres from the main area, but it's up such a steep hill that by the time you get there, you think, well, that's my cardiovascular for the day. But there was never anyone there. Snorkeling tours. We did walk a bit further up the beach, up the coastline, and found a disused resort where they'd run out of money, but the good thing was there was still all these beautiful buildings and umbrellas and seats and everything. But again, no one there. It was like an empty, it was quite chilling. But
like an abandoned resort.
Yes, that's right. They're very well put, an abandoned resort. That's right.
Yeah.
We stayed there for a couple of hours, and the monkeys would come down and try and pinch our food and clothes, but you had to be on the lookout for the monkeys. They're very cheeky bastards.
They are cheeky little buggers. They really are, and they'll take anything. They'll take your camera. They'll take your wallet.
Yes, that's right. If you go there, we were warned by a French family first up, and they said, don't leave your clothes that far away from us. But also, the interesting thing was that Cham Island, we went to a temple there, a Buddhist temple, and there was a very big military presence in the sense of there was an army base there and also the coastal protection mob with their boats, because apparently the South China Sea there obviously is the scene of much intrusion by Chinese vessels. This was evidenced by the number of patrol boats and military personnel on the island. It's a fishing village. It's almost like a Vietnamese version of Doc Martin's village in England.
Beautiful.
So small but beautiful. And again, recommended if anyone's going to Vietnam, please take the time to go to Cham Island. The fishing, there's a place called Coconut Beach we went to too, which is just beautiful.
You know, I know that I'd mentioned a couple of things that I would love to see. I've not been to Vietnam. The topography, as I call it, that is the landscape of Vietnam, is really something to behold, especially those sawing sort of mountainous rocks that go up. They're almost, you know, they're all clustered together. And those that are by the beach in the seaways and so on, that is really quite spectacular. Did you get to see any of that?
One of the most romantically beautiful parts of the trip, of course, to Vietnam is that the hills and the mountains that you so accurately described. And often if the clouds are low enough, it adds that air of mystique because it's all very misty. But the beauty of the country itself is one reason alone to visit. But of course, when you combine that with the history and the loveliness of the people, then that's also very good.
Well, it makes it a very, very special place to consider. If any of our listeners are looking for somewhere different to go, it's Vietnam.
Yes, indeed. I would recommend that to anyone. When you combine the fact that it's amazingly affordable due to the dong Australian dollar conversion,
yes,
there's no reason not to go, Gary.
Now, tell me about your final night, and we'll wrap it up on this point. You went to An Bang Beach.
An Bang is quite incredible. A lot of visitors and tourists there, but no, it's no wonder, Gary, because it was voted one of the, I think 25 most picturesque beaches in Asia, I think a few years ago now by TripAdvisor. And yes, there's surf there, so you can get your little bodyboard and have a surf, and then you can go to the bar and have a drink or whatever, and some lovely restaurants too. So there's a combination of things there that make it a very attractive place. We spent our last night there, and there was a woman there outside her place just washing dogs. She wasn't accepting payment for it. She just wanted to see clean dogs, and
yes,
the dogs were all lining up to be washed.
I remember seeing your pictures of this lady, and the dogs were kind of lining up there in the street.
Yes, they were. And look, the whole thing with Cham Island and An Bang Beach and all that, Cham Island's only 5 kilometres boat ride from Hoi An. It takes about 20 minutes in a speedboat. It can be a bit hairy at times, but An Bang Beach is where you leave for Cham Island. But the basket boats there at An Bang Beach were striking the traditional Vietnamese basket boats. So, yeah, beach lounges and thatched umbrella along the beach there. And, one of the best beach resorts in Vietnam, I'd say.
Fantastic.
It's a lovely way to finish the journey.
Yeah. And I think on that note, too, that was a wonderful way to finish what we've been talking about here. It was almost like a bittersweet trip for you, though, wasn't it? Because it's been a country that has seen war on more than one occasion, and a very protracted war.
Look, I tell you what, striking and a sad note that so many young men and women lost their lives in a war that could have been avoided. One of the striking things, Gary, was that the South Vietnamese and North Vietnamese combined both spoke to me about the war as being a civil war. They said it wasn't the Vietnam War to us. It was our civil war.
Yes, it was.
And when you look at it that way, it was a needless loss of life and energy and money. And beautiful people, beautiful countryside. Yes, they did have a dispute. And, of course, there's still a regional differences, let's put it that way. But it is one country. The sadness involved with Australia and America and South Korea and New Zealand and Canada, I think, too, was the loss of life, Gary. The first Australian killed in Vietnam, it was killed only 24 hours or 48 hours after arriving there, and he was only 18 or 19 or something. It just shows you the tragedy. Just a final word, Gary. Look, here in Australia, we've got lots of, tributes, heritage things to do with the Vietnam War. But one of the best things is the National Vietnam Veterans Museum down at Phillip Island in Victoria, Gary.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
It's fantastic, and you know, but obviously there it's down at New Haven. It's just next to the airfield on the main Phillip Island Road. It's volunteer run and created to dedicate to the heritage and legacy of the vets. So if you're interested in the Vietnam War and the legacy and history of the veterans, then get along to the National Veterans Museum down there in Phillip Island, and they'll look after you. A great mob down there and a great museum.
Greg, welcome back. You take care. We'll look forward to seeing you next time with episode number 8.
Oh, it's a wonderful thing, Gary. I'll tell you what, we'll soon be in double figures. That's wonderful.